Hello, I'm Ken McLeod, Principal Teacher at Unfettered Mind. Our website is an ongoing effort to explain Buddhist practice in a way that is clear and accessible to the Western mind without dumbing it down. If you find these teachings useful, please make a donation at unfetteredmind.org/donate so we can continue to maintain and expand the site. Thanks.
Unfettered Mind. Resting in attention.
I want to touch on these two topics. Let's start with the practice that we're doing right now, which is essentially a Mahamudra approach to Shamatha. Now, there's a lot of terminology that flies around in Buddhism, which I don't think is particularly helpful. Some of it's even traditional terminology, badly translated. What I'm thinking of here are things like shamatha with support and shamatha without support, or shamatha with an object, shamatha without an object, form meditation, formless meditation. Any of you heard any of these terms? Yeah. People get wonderfully tied up in knots about them. The purpose, or what we're aiming for at this point, is cultivating a basis of attention. And for some people, that is more easily done if they use a reference point, such as the breath, or a actual object. And for other people, it's more easily done if they don't use an object. What's important here is to focus on is to keep the intention. And the intention is to cultivate a base of attention. Now, there's only one way to cultivate a base of attention, and that is to do something which requires some attention, doesn't require much thinking, and do it over and over again. And one can liken cultivating a base of attention to learning scales in music, or if you're using a wind instrument, learning how to blow the instrument in a nice even tone, or if it's a string instrument such as a violin, learning how to draw the bow. It's a basic skill. There's nothing particularly magical about it. And the way you learn, the way you do that, any of those things, is you just do them over and over again. When you do them over and over again, you make tons and tons of errors. You know, you miss notes in the scales, or the bow wavers, or your breath isn't steady, or whatever. But when you're doing that, you don't regard that as a problem. You just say, okay, that's how that is. And then you do the next one. And little by little, things get better. Now, how many of you beat yourself up every time you fall off the breath? Or there you are sitting in open awareness and you fall out of it and then you beat yourself up, right? How helpful is this beating yourself up? I'm going to send Ralph to Raton and ask him to get a good supply of baseball bats. So everybody, whenever they fall off the breath, they go bang, bang. Pardon?
I said gladly.
Many people approach meditation practice as they would approach SAT or a GMAT or something like that. They have this one chance to get it right. It's a practice. And the thing about a practice is you expect to fail. You don't expect to do it perfectly. And that's why you're practicing it, so you get better at it. How many of you approach meditation this way? Everybody's trying to do it right all the time. It's a practice. So you fall down, fall off the breath, fall off, fall out of attention, time and time again. So that's the first piece that I want to convey this evening. It is, approach this retreat as practice. And fall out of attention, okay? Start again. And you just do this again and again and again. And there's a saying in Chinese, to learn how to do something, do it 10,000 times. That's all. Don't worry about the first 10,000 times. After that, if things aren't coming together, then you can get a little concerned. But not for the first 10,000, okay? Something to keep in mind, because I suspect this operates in a few of you. Who are you trying to impress with your meditation practice? Janet? But you got to impress somebody, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Not quite sure who, but there's somebody there that's going to be impressed. And I'm going to make sure that they're impressed with my meditation practice. So, you know, the nice thing about meditation practice is when you finish, nobody gives you a round of applause. And you think that this is funny, but this is how many people practice meditation. As if, you know, they're on stage, they've got to do it perfectly, and then when nobody gives them a round of applause, they kind of miffed afterwards. Where's my recognition? Okay. So it's a practice. You're not going to impress anybody. The consequence of that is you can completely relax in this. You want the deep, dark secret here? You're the only person who's going to notice if you don't do it perfectly. Nobody else. But that's not how we approach it. Now, some of that comes from an idealism, a yearning for an ideal. This is also very problematic, and it's encouraged very, very highly in most Buddhist traditions. I mean, yeah, from the Zen tradition, sentient beings, numberless, I vow to save them all. Mm-hmm. And reactive emotions are infinite. I vow to release them all. The gates to the Dharma are infinite. I vow to enter them all. Awakenings are limitless. I vow to engage them all. Nothing idealistic. One of the things that we've lost in the West, and this is really, this died out about 100 years ago, is the use of formal language and mythic language in how we communicate with each other. The four vows that I just recited, which is the form the Bodhisattva vow takes in the Zen tradition, this is mythic language. It serves to inspire, to move emotionally, and you don't take it literally, because it doesn't make any sense, literally. We grow up in the culture, it's a modern culture, postmodern, in which the intellect, thanks to the likes of Descartes and others, was placed above reason, above emotion. To some extent, this goes back as far as Aristotle, but it really gained ascendancy in the what's now referred to as the Enlightenment, which it wasn't. But, in which reason was seen to be the ideal, and this led to several generations of people repressing their emotions and so forth. And a lot of good came out of this in one sense, in that there was, and it came out of the development of the scientific method and the use of reason as applying to understanding the world. And when you're working scientifically, whether it's in medicine or physics or biology, whatever you read, whatever you write, you intend it to be taken absolutely literally, because you're trying to describe things very precisely. And when you read an account of a scientific experiment or a diagnosis of a disease or what have you, you read it absolutely literally. It's not poetry, it's not symbolic, it's not mythic or anything like that. And over what's now a few hundred years, this has been the primary way we relate to things. We've lost that to a large extent, being able to talk about things symbolically, indirectly. And I had a very explicit experience of this when I was having a conversation along these lines with a psychologist. And he said, well, what do you mean, this mythic language? And I said, well, in Tibetan Buddhism, it says, regard your teacher as Buddha. And before I'd even finished the sentence, he said, so he's infallible, right? Mm-hmm. I said, perfect. That is the literal trap that you fall into. It doesn't at all mean that your teacher is infallible. That's taking it literally. What it means is that, for whatever reason, you regard this particular person as how you experience awakened mind in the world. That's what it means. That's how you experience waking mind, is through this person that you come to learn and understand and come into connection with awakened mind. And that is one of the primary functions of the teacher, is to reveal awakening to the student. But that has nothing to do with infallibility. That's another projection, modern projection, on the notion of being awake. It's that you're perfect, like some kind of Superman. Thank you, Nietzsche. You see, this is where all of these ideas come, and they're laid on top of these traditional teachings.
So, the Catholic doctrine in terms of the Pope and infallible.
Do you know when the Pope? Do you know when doctrine of papal infallibility developed?
One of the councils.
Pardon?
20th century.
That was in the very late 1892.
Yeah.
1892. That was when it became official doctrine. Mm-hmm. And it was a reaction to the ascent of science. They needed to have something which said, this is how it is. So it's not a traditional or an ancient view. It is a modern view. And it's a reaction to what else was taking place in the culture. Okay. It's very important to know these things.
Well, coincides with what you're saying about also mythic.
Exactly. Yeah, because that was about the period where it was really largely lost. It's a pain in the neck for translating. You can't translate anything into High English anymore because it just sounds stupid. Because we don't use High English, formal language. The only place that is used at all is somewhat in diplomatic circles now. Okay. So, a lot of instruction in Buddhism is expressed in mythic language. I will give you one example. It happens to be a Mahamudra instruction. I thought I'd keep it on topic. Body like a mountain, breath like the wind, mind like the sky. Now, I think this is quite a good example. If I say body like a mountain, what do most of you think of immediately? Yeah. Okay. Now, what's it like meditating like that? Does it work? No. So is this what it means?
No.
So what does it mean?
Nick? It can be very stable.
How do you become very stable? Can you just say, I'm going to be stable? Does that work?
That's a relaxed body.
What does that have to do with a mountain?
Mountains don't make any effort to sit there like that.
Exactly. Say it again loudly so we get it on there.
Sorry, I said mountains don't make any effort to sit like that.
Yeah. So this phrase, body like a mountain, means to sit without any effort whatsoever. And you come at this by actually just taking it in and letting it speak to you, not trying to analyze it and figure out exactly what it means, etc., etc. Okay. This is the language of poetry. And similar things with breath like the wind, mind like the sky. So, in what we work with in these days that we're here together, let the instructions sit in you. Let them reveal their meaning. You'll know when they've revealed their meaning by what happens in your practice. A lot of people think that shamatha means having no thoughts. Calm abiding means having no thoughts. And we find lots and lots of descriptions of states of mind in which there's very little thinking going on, or there's no thinking. How does that come about? Does it come about by trying to have no thoughts? Yeah, so we have a little experience in that. How does it come about?
It's the resting where it's born.
Pardon?
The resting where it's born.
Yes. And that's why I'm emphasizing the resting. You notice I'm not emphasizing being quiet. And this is another thing that is worth noting. I make a moderately big deal of this and wake up to your life. When you are receiving instruction from anybody, and if any of you are in the position, ever in the position of giving instruction or guidance in meditation, pay very, very close attention to distinguishing method from results. What happens over time is that the distinction between these two is blurred. And there's definite reasons why this happens. Because all of you have some experience, I can talk in a kind of shorthand. And I can say, do this. And all of you already know how to do X. Where, properly speaking, X is the result of doing something else. So, if I were working with another group of people, I wouldn't say do X, because they don't have that experience to work with. I would have to say do Y, and then they experience the result X. For instance, if you say to someone who's a bit tense, relax, what happens? Yeah, why don't you just relax? Okay. That's an example of X. But if you say to the person, take a deep breath, let it out slowly, take another deep breath, let it out slowly, now take another deep breath and let it out slowly, how do you feel? They will usually say, oh, relaxed. Okay, that's the method. Now, when somebody knows how to do that, you can say, okay, relax, and they will just go. They will just do what they know to be the method. This is one way that result and method get confused, because you have people with different levels of experience and ability and so forth. But it's extremely important when you're learning something for the first time, and when you're teaching, is to make these distinctions. Because if you describe the results to people and people try to practice the results, they will get into a hell of a mess. So the method here is resting. As we rest, we create the conditions in which which body and mind can grow quiet. But if we were to say, make your body and mind quiet, we'd have a lot of uptight people very quickly.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.